Radio. Thursday morning, January 6th, and it's really cold out there. As Adam mentioned in our weather report, it's going to be cold a lot this week. And right now, I just checked my phone. It says it's 16 degrees out there. And not only is it 16 degrees, but the wind chill factor has it down to 6 degrees. So make sure you put your coat on and get your coat for your little kitty cat or your puppy dog if you're going to take them out, and because they're going to need it as well. Never quite understand how you put little booties on on either a cat or a dog, but I guess there are people that do that sort of thing. I'm not one of them. Hey, we're giving you your annual civics lesson, okay? And most of this stuff I've researched. I am not just pulling this off the top of my head. I actually have looked this stuff up, and I'm going to try to give you the best, very short primer on our Constitution and the amendments in the Constitution here in the next 45 minutes. Now, there are a lot of people that don't know. They've thought since 1776 we had the Constitution. That is not quite true. In 1776, that was when we declared our independence, but we really didn't have a form of government. So several of the very rich and well-heeled and well-educated gentlemen of the 13 states, and they weren't even considered states at the time, got together and they said, we ought to make up some sort of rules to live by. Well, in 1778, the rules that they declared were what they're going to live by were called the Articles of Confederation. And I'm going to tell you the difference between the Articles of Confederation, which were established in 1778, and the Constitution, which was established in 1788, 10 years later. There are definitely some differences. In the Articles of Confederation, the governing offices were unicameralism. In other words, there was only one. You were either in the government or you were not in the government. There was a single chamber, basically, of parliament. There were not two, three, five. There was one chamber. Now, I don't know what it was called. That would be a good question. I should look that up. I didn't. But the Constitution, 10 years later, decided that we needed bicameralism. That means there were two divisions in our Congress. And there was that was divided into our Senate and our Congress, House. And the House was basically devised for all the rabble. All of us who were not wealthy, well-heeled people. And then there was the office, or there was the Senate, and there were, each state got two votes in the Senate. And that was really more for the well-heeled electors. They were intended to be, you know, prominent, well-educated, rich, non-slave people. Matter of fact, even in at that time, slaves were not allowed to, even in the House of Representatives. But so that's one of the major differences to start with. Each state had a single vote according to the Articles of Confederation. There were 13 states. Every state could vote. If you wanted to pass amendment, you had to have 100% of all 13 states. Therefore, no amendments were offered for the Articles of Confederation. Now, under the Constitution, each legislative representative has a vote, not just one vote for everybody. Each legislative representative has a vote in both the House and the Senate. That's a huge difference, because that gets a lot closer to one man, one vote. And I'm going to use the generic term one man, one vote, but back then that was truly what it was. It was one man, one vote. Women had no choice. In 1778, under the Articles of Confederation, the Articles of Confederation distributed the power between many different unions. It'll be easier to understand when I explain. The Constitution says it divides power between subordinates, but the ultimate power resides with the central authority. In other words, there are a lot of different ways you can vote now under the Constitution, and it does all reside under the Congress, okay? But there are lots of different ways now, whereas in times past, it was not that way. The Bill of Rights. The citizens were not able to claim any of the Bill of Rights, which, by the way, are the first 10 amendments of the Constitution. And under the Articles of Confederation, you had no right. You didn't really have that type of rights. But the Constitution considers everybody equally, and hence the Bill of Rights can be claimed by all citizens. Now, mind you, there were a lot of non-citizens that lived within the borders of the states, slaves, women, Native Americans. You know, lots of different people had no rights at all at that time. But we were moving in the right direction, I guess. 9 out of 13 states should have to support the laws to enforce them everywhere. So if you wanted a law that said you can't kill somebody, 9 out of the 10 states had to agree to that, okay? But both houses in Parliament have to support a law to amend it to the country. So if you decide you want to make it illegal to kill people, it has to be voted on by both houses, and it has to win by a majority. Therefore, that is a difference. Now, at the same time, they decided that they needed to have better representatives rather than every single person. I mean, one man, one vote sounds good, but you couldn't have each and every man at that time coming in and telling you what they, if they thought you should be allowed to kill people or not. So you had to have the representative. And when they were voting for the president and vice president, they developed a system where they had the Electoral College, where they voted on electors from your state. Each state was allowed the number of electors was the whole number of senators and congressmen from that state. So like in New York, you'd have two senators and let's say five congresspeople. So you'd have seven electoral college people. Well, what that has done, and one of the reasons why several of us more progressive Democrats have said we ought to do away with the electoral colleges, what that did at the time is that made those electors were intended, this is why they did it, they were intended to be those prominent, educated, rich landowners to elect the president. That would keep the rabble, you and I, that would keep us out of the business of selecting the president and vice president. It has kind of fallen upon, well, people started to realize that that was senseless, but they kept it in there as an archaic law, and it's still there, and we still, it caused us some problems recently, because if those electors' votes were not accepted by the vice president, they could have said that Joe Biden was not duly elected president. That has caused some problems. They could have also said that Trump was not elected in the previous election, but that did not hold either. So, anyway, some of the things that you could do under the Article of Confederation, you could declare war, you can could conduct foreign affairs, and you could make treaties. It was kind of a weak federal government because that's all you could do. The main thing that caused problems is you couldn't collect taxes. The way they supported the government financially was through tariffs from other countries, and that just wasn't working. It worked fine for the elite because they didn't care, but it did not work for your average person who wanted education to be free and wanted us to have things that we didn't have through declaring war or conducting foreign affairs or making treaties. The Constitution was a much stronger national government as opposed to state government. The Articles of Confederation was stronger in states' rights, and the Constitution was stronger in national rights. It did create both of the houses, congressmen are elected for 2 years, and senators are elected for 6 years. Now, the senators, they've arranged it so every 2 years, a different group is voted in or out. So every 2 years, you have a change of that. Whereas in Congress, every 2 years, you have a change, but you can be voted completely out after 2 years, whereas in the Senate, you've got 6 years to make your bones, as they call it. All right? I hope that explains it a little bit better. But let's talk about the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is really what was established initially after we decided that we were going to have a constitution. They said, hey, wait a minute, there are a lot of things that we didn't put in the constitution, so we need to amend the constitution. And the Bill of Rights were designed, and I didn't write it down, who was the main framer of the Bill of Rights. I guess I didn't write it down. It was one of the famous guys. And by the way, those people that were in charge of our government at this time were very smart people, but they were not gods. They didn't do anything that was completely perfect. They did a lot of things, like Well, they did a lot of things that were not quite perfect, but it's held up pretty strongly. We are now up to 27 amendments, but the first 10 amendments really took care of us for a long time. And the first amendment, I'm going to go over these amendments with you so that you know really what the Bill of Rights tells you you can have. The First Amendment says that Congress will make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof of any religion or abridging the freedom of speech or press or the right of people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for redresses of grievances. Now, that's a lot of words. It basically says we have free speech, free press, and the right to assemble. And that's been kind of under siege lately. Sorry, I had a quick cough there. Now, the definition of press, we all have our individual definition of press, but I'll tell you what, without free press, our government doesn't work very well, I don't believe. I think we need the free press. We need both sides to be able to say that's right and that's wrong. We need the free press to be able to hold a spotlight to some of the really rotten things that some of our representatives are doing. Excuse me. I have a coffee thing going. So that was very important. And the opportunity to say what you want to say is a major portion of that. Now, we all know the rule about you can't scream fire in a theater. And there are adjustments that have had to be made to all these rules. But it's a good basis, a good solid, firm ground to plant that number one amendment. The second amendment states that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state and the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, that has really come under a lot of scrutiny lately. Initially, the founders of our government had no idea that there would be such a thing as a nuclear shoulder rocket launcher. They didn't know things like that. What they were trying to do, in all my research, what they were trying to do was to make sure that the government couldn't provide military that would put down the locals. You know, we do have opportunities now. The National Guard is brought in sometimes when there's significant disruption of our government, but that was what it was basically initially started for, is to regulate, to make sure it was regulated, but also make sure it regulated the federal army couldn't come in and take over. So you had local, which now has kind of turned into the National Guard, but you have local militia, and then you have the federal militia, and it was a check for the federal armies. Now, they had no idea stating this in the year 2022, really it's basically saying that the government should allow you to own a tank, or the government should allow you to own a nuclear weapon. That's what it's saying. And as we've moved along, we've found out that there should be adjustments to that. As a matter of fact, 10, 15 years ago, there was an adjustment to it that you couldn't have military-style rifles. The AR-15 was banned. There are all sorts of rules around this. Now, should you be able to strap on a six-shooter and go down the main street of Marion and call somebody out and shoot them? You know, that type of thing was possible back then. Nowadays, I'm not so certain it's very wise to have that sort of ability. But that's... and we'll fight about that for a long time to come. What is the ability for people to bear arms? It was basically because they had muskets back then. And it was a good idea to have a check and a balance on the National Army. If you want to take the National Guard out and have them fight our entire military, the National Guard's going to lose. So we don't have that check and balance anymore. So things do have to change. We decide how they change. And that's part of our Constitution. The Third Amendment says that no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. That's meaning the government can't tell you you have to put 14 basic trainee people in your house because they've run out of space at Fort Leonard Woods, right? They can't force you to room, feed, and house the soldiers. The United States government or the state government is going to be required to pay for that. That's pretty simple, pretty straightforward, and I don't think we've ever had too much problem with that. The Fourth Amendment, the right of people to secure in their persons, houses, or papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, and that shall not be violated. No warrants shall be issued, but... upon probable cause, support by oath or affirmation, and the particular describing the place to be searched and the persons and things to be seized. Basically, you can't go into a person's house and just take what you want to take if you're the government. You have to provide them with a statement of why you're there. You have to let them know what you're going to take, show them what you took. You have to be able to return it if you had no right to take it. And that's a pretty good amendment to secure the people's rights. The Fifth Amendment, no person shall be held to answer for capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indiction of a grand jury. In other words, you have to be, the reason why you're going to answer to capital offenses is a grand jury says there's a good chance you broke some rules like that. That's a protection for the people. You can't just willy-nilly go and tell somebody, okay, I want all your papers on everything. unless you have cause and you can prove it to the grand jury, right? And you can't deprive a person of life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness or property. You just can't do it without having the permission of a grand jury, which is going to go lean towards the people rather than towards the government. Sixth Amendment, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial. Now, that has kind of been... what, you know, the definition of what a speedy trial is different in different people's. And some people want the trial to linger so that they can run out the clock on things, which is going on right now in some things. And it has to be by an impartial jury in the state of the district wherein the crime shall have been committed. So you can't take a person to Alaska if he committed a crime in Georgia, okay? Now, there are some rules that allow you to adjust where you have the trial, but in general, you have to have it in the same area where the crime was supposedly committed. And you have to allow the person to be confronted with witnesses against that person. You have to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in favor of the defendant, and have to have assistance of counsel for the defense. So if a person can't afford his defense, the state and the government is required to provide that for him. The Seventh Amendment. In suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by jury shall be otherwise re-examined. In other words, you can't be held for the same mistake twice, or the same broken law twice. Once you've been judged, that's it. It's done. They can't do it. Can't bring you back and say, "Oh, wait a minute. I think we ought to do that again because I think we could get a better result out of this by trying this person a second time for robbing that bank." Right? Okay. The Eighth Amendment goes against excessive bail. Kind of like the voting tax. They were trying to make a rule that let the common man be a little bit more free, right? Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishment inflicted. Which has caused us, you know, in our capital punishment, we've gone all through all sorts of things. You can't it depends on the state a little bit, but you can't hang somebody. You can't run somebody through the guillotine. You can't beat a person to death for capital crimes. I have to wait till this police car goes by. Wanted to make sure they weren't going to stop here. But excessive punishment like that, unusual punishment, is frowned upon by our Constitution. Now, people have to decide what excessive unusual punishment is, and they have decided that having your head chopped off was excessive. They have decided that charging you $1 million for a speeding ticket was excessive. That type of thing. Okay, that was the Eighth Amendment. Now the Ninth Amendment, enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So the Constitution gives you certain rights, but other rights can't be denied. That's a little bit more vague, and I'm going to just leave it at the reading of what the amendment is. I've got another thing here that let's see here if this explains it better. Ninth Amendment, okay, it basically is covering other rights that you have as a person that's charged with some sort of criminal process. The tenth, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited to it by the states, are reserved for the state respectively or to the people. So if it isn't in law, they can't charge you for something. They can't charge you for not vacuuming your living room rug. Because there's no law about that, right? I'm thinking of that because my wife's coming home this weekend. I gotta go vacuum my front room. All right, now those are the first 10 of the amendments. Now they did that almost immediately upon establishing the Constitution because they realized they had left some things out and they wanted to make sure those were covered. So the first 10 were done almost immediately after the Constitution was established. Now there are 17 more that have been added, and we'll go over those a little bit. Wouldn't you like to know about them? We've only got about 15 more minutes till we switch over to Swap Shop, but I'm going to continue this if we don't get through with it. I'm going to continue it into Swap Shop, and you can do your swapping as well as your listening to your civics lesson for this this year. The 11th Amendment, it was passed back in 1794, but ratified. Now, see, these things can be passed, but aren't ratified because they have to be ratified by a majority of the states. So this was passed March 4th, 1794, but not ratified till almost a year later, February 7th of 95. And it's the 11th Amendment, and the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit of law, in law, or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States citizens by another state or the citizen or subjects of any foreign state. And, you know, that's a lot of gobbledygook, but what it says is you can't sue a state that you don't live in because their law says you can't do something. Now, there are lots of rules that have been adjusted about that, but that's in general what it says. The 12th Amendment, the election of presidents. This was passed December 9th, 1803, so this was a little bit later than the 11th, but it was ratified in June of 04. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for the president and vice president. The president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and the House representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. Okay, we just went through that, and that's kind of what's going on today, right? There was an effort to not allow the vice president to open the those votes. Now, it was brought to the chambers for. I'm trying to think what the word is. They wanted to agree that that they were correctly voted upon, they did open them up, but there were many of the people that were rioting were trying to stop the opportunity to open those certificates and the votes, so therefore they couldn't be counted. And if they weren't counted, then it kind of goes, the rule later moves it over to the I'm not sure if it's the House or the Congress or whether it's both of them, but they can vote on their own of who they want as president and vice president. And fortunately, Mr. Pence would not allow that to go ahead. Now, a lot of people really thought he should, but I would generally say, in general, the American public did not want that. They wanted to be able to know that their vote meant something rather than overriding their vote. All right? I know some of this gets a little in the weeds and a little bit difficult. I'll try the best I can. Some of these things I can't explain to myself, let alone to you. In January of 1865, which this law was ratified in December of 65, about slavery. Now, this was right after the Civil War. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime. In other words, the involuntary servitude might mean that you were on a chain gang, right? But other than that, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude was accepted was not allowed to exist in the United States or any place subject to the United States jurisdiction. So, let's say Puerto Rico, right? It's a territory. You can't allow slavery or involuntary servitude in Puerto Rico. Not unusual. Actually, in the world, there wasn't a lot of slavery when we had so much slavery. We needed the slavery to do the picking of the cotton and the tobacco and that sort of thing. Whereas most of the world was not relying on that sort of thing. But that was the 13th Amendment is the one that is always referred to as doing away with slavery. Now remember, that was passed on January 31st, 1865, immediately after the Civil War ended. And it was ratified on December 6th, 1865, the 13th Amendment. Probably one of the most important amendments outside of the Bill of Rights that we've passed of the 27 different amendments that we have passed. The 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment has, parts of it have kind of come up in discussions lately. The privileges and immunities of citizenship, due process and equal protection. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state. In other words, you have dual citizenship. You are a citizen of the United States, but you are also a citizen, if you live here, of Ohio, right? So you are you have a dual citizenship. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So a state can't make a law that goes against what the federal government has already made as a national law. Okay? Representatives shall be apportioned among several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians who are not taxed. But when the right to vote on any election or the choice of President and Vice President of the United States, representatives in Congress and the executive and the judicial officer of the state, the members of the legislature, therefore, is denied to any male inhabitants of such state, being 21 years of age. Anyway, it gets a little hunky there. I'm sorry. All this applies except if you're in the participation of a rebellion, okay? Which kind of came up a year ago, didn't it? No person shall be a senator. This is another thing that kind of has come up about this. No person, and this is part of the 14th Amendment, no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who have previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer in the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer in any state to support the Constitution of the United States. In other words, anybody who's taken the oath to support the Constitution of the United States, they are not allowed to engage in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of two-thirds of each house, remove such disability. That has also kind of come up, hasn't it? If you are one of those people mentioned, you cannot have given aid or comfort, and you cannot be part of any rebellion or insurrection according to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. All right. We'll do the 15th Amendment, and then we're going to take our break, and we'll come back and finish up the latter 12 amendments while we're doing the swap shop. Is that all right? I hope so. I know this gets a little weedy, and it's hard to read. Believe me, it's hard to read, especially if you have dyslexia. So I'm doing my best. I'm sorry. But the 15th Amendment is the Racial Equality in Voting Amendment. And it basically is pretty clear cut. It says the right of citizens in the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on the account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. In other words, if you had been a slave, now this took place in February of 1869. So if you had been a slave somewhere, they couldn't deny your right to vote. Boy, I'm really struggling right now with this cough. If you had been, no matter what your color, or your race, or your previous condition of whether you were owned or not owned, whether you were a slave, you had the right to vote. Now, there were laws that said African Americans were only three-fifths of a real person, which, thank goodness, has been changed. But that sort of thing went on. But you did have the right to vote, okay? Let's go ahead and do the 16th Amendment because it's a pretty simple one and we're all kind of getting ready to do this, so we should know why we're getting ready to do this. The 16th Amendment is about income tax. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any consensus or enumeration. In other words, you got to pay taxes. Now, there's a lot of noise about that right now. There are a lot of multi-billionaires that pay no taxes. They have a different type of taxing thing, but it's still illegal for you not to pay the taxes that you owe, and that's what the 16th Amendment was set up to do, and that was passed on in July of 1909 and finally ratified. It took 4 years to ratify it, in February of 1913. So there were probably a lot of rich people that were fighting that tooth and nail. All right, well, we're going to break away here in about a minute, and then we'll come back after that and do the 17th Amendment, which is the election of U.S. senators. Maybe we'll be a little smarter by the end of the next 45 minutes. I hope you're kind of enjoying this. I enjoy going over this. It makes me smarter. It's easier for me to tell people rather than reading these really legalistic statements. It's easier to tell what it's all about. And I do have a thing here that in a easy sentence tells all of this, and I probably should have read that before, but like the 16th Amendment, it's the income tax amendment. The 15th Amendment is the racial equality and voting amendment. Pretty simple. I thought you'd be interested to know kind of what the wording says, because it does kind of change things. All right, we're going to break away here. We'll be back in about 15 minutes. Thanks for joining us.
This is WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, your place for the latest news in politics. From Scott Spears at the